And good afternoon. This is Live and Local. I'm Kevin Kelly. The show is your connection to local performances. Coming up, we will be talking with and hearing live in our studio a couple of folks from Champaign-Urbana who play the Native American flute. And they're actually interested in finding folks of like mind, I guess, and like instrumental proclivities. I'm interested in hearing them myself and hearing some recorded music that involves that instrument. So that's coming up live later on this hour. But first, I'll be talking with pianist Olga Kern. She was the winner of the 2001 Van Cliburn International Piano Competition, gold medal winner, as a matter of fact, and she's going to be playing with the Peoria Symphony Orchestra tomorrow night at a concert that starts at 8 o'clock at the Peoria Civic Center Theater. The program also includes music by Richard Wagner and Claude Debussy and Strauss' Death and Transfiguration. She's going to be playing music by Rachmaninoff, his Rhapsody on a Theme of Paganini. We just heard music by Sergei Rachmaninoff, the opening of his Rhapsody on a Theme of Paganini, in a performance from 1972 by pianist Van Cliburn with the Moscow Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Kirill Kondrashin. And the Peoria Symphony will play that piece on Saturday, tomorrow night, with soloist Olga Kern, who was winner of the Van Cliburn competition in 2001. And she is with me on the phone right now for a brief chat. Thanks very much for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
It's been a long time, of course, since that particular competition, but it's at the forefront of your bio. Here you are doing music by Rachmaninoff on this concert. And I noticed from just reading your bio that you claim some direct links to Tchaikovsky and Rachmaninoff. I'm just kind of curious to know what those are.
Yeah, it's not really like direct links, but my great-grandmother She was a singer, a mezzo-soprano, and she was touring a lot in Russia and abroad. And that time she was touring with Rachmaninoff songs, and her accompanist got sick in one of the places, and she couldn't find anybody to accompany her because the Rachmaninoff songs were written really difficult for the piano. And then it happened that Rachmaninoff himself was in that place, and he was telling her that, why you're asking and trying to find somebody if I'm right here and I will do this for you. And Rachmaninoff himself accompanied my great-grandmother in the concert, and we still have, you know, my family has a program from that concert, and we have in his two books of his memoirs, it's written that in that date, in that place, Rachmaninoff was accompanying my great-grandmother. And this is great. Of course, it's so special for me and for my family. And her mother, my great-great-grandmother, she was a very good pianist and very good friend of Tchaikovsky. And we have absolutely unique letters and photos from Tchaikovsky to my great-great-grandmother.
And has this sort of helped to give you a, or helped to foster a particular attachment to his music?
You know, it's just, it's so natural for me because all my family musicians and my parents both pianists, I always grew up in the, you know, music sound, and especially sound of the piano. For me, it was absolutely natural to start to play this instrument. I always was in love with this instrument, and I always wanted to play Rachmaninoff because my parents had so much of the recordings by Rachmaninoff, and I always wanted to do that. And, you know, Rachmaninoff wrote such a great piano pieces. He was such a master of the piano because he was a great pianist himself. And because I always loved that instrument, I always wanted to play Rachmaninoff.
Well, I wanted to play a recording of yours in which you're doing one of Rachmaninoff's transcriptions, of which he's made a great many by of music by other composers. This is one that he made of music by Bach from one of his solo violin partitas. Yeah, this is it's fabulous playing, incredibly sparkling playing, and it sort of reminded me of somebody's review of one of your performances where they said, quote, referred to your dazzling virtuosity in the Horowitz manner. And this sort of struck me that way, a lot of sparkle to it in let's say, the way that Horowitz might have played. Do you, I assume you take that as a compliment.
It is a compliment. Thank you, yes. Yeah.
Well, I mean, the notion of, you know, the Horowitz manner. Well, maybe I'll ask you about that in a minute, but let's hear this. It's Bach's music as transcribed by Rachmaninoff and played by Olga Karin here on Live and Local.
Thank you.
This music by Bach is transcribed by Rachmaninoff. The prelude from his violin partita number 3. Olga Karin played it on the piano, of course. She's my guest in Live and Local as she is about to play with the Peoria Symphony tomorrow night. Music by Rachmaninoff for piano and orchestra. I mentioned the virtuosity in the Horowitz manner, and it seems like these little bonbons or short little gems are things that people like Rachmaninoff and Horowitz would have done in a sort of sparkly virtuoso style. I wonder if you are able to talk a little bit about how you approach this kind of music. I mean, it doesn't seem like, I mean, you do way, way more than just play the notes and play it straight and play it cleanly. It really seems like you're inventing on the spot almost.
You know, of course, Rachmaninoff's music, you must play kind of, in the way that he always felt himself, being so lonely and so homesick, because especially when he wrote all his best compositions, he was already immigrated to the United States, and of course that affected his music, and his mood. And he, as I said, he was such a great pianist that everything he wrote is quite difficult for piano technically. And of course, you must have ability, technical ability to be able to perform Rachmaninoff's music. And this is why we can hear, Horowitz playing Rachmaninoff, and we always say how great it is, because Horowitz had such an incredible technique that actually he used his technique to make really great music. And this is what I'm doing, because I don't have a problem with any technical parts of it, and it helps me to actually get this technical part. It gets me to another level, and then I can actually take this and help me to to interpret exactly how I want it to interpret. And of course, because I'm Russian, I know how it feels to play Rachmaninoff's music, because he was so sad not to see Russian nature, Russian country, and that sadness. You always need to feel the sadness in his music, and it is very important to have these feelings when you perform Rachmaninoff's music. He was so great as a romantic, and he wrote such a great melodies, but at the same time, he really was so homesick that you could feel in every note that there is some tragedy behind it.
I've seen a couple of video interviews with you before, and heard some audio and seen clips of you playing, and you don't seem to carry that sort of sadness yourself. I mean, you have a lot of sparkle in your personality. Do you think that ever gets in the way of your interpreting some of his, deeper pieces? Like, for example, this year you're doing all of his concertos plus the Rhapsody, sometimes in one location.
I can't say that. Of course, I want to look at myself as an optimist and a happy person, but of course I'm not. Especially, because I think every Russian, even if he or she happy, is always there is always sadness in them, in every Russian person. And I think that I always feel his tragedy, his loneliness, his things he's put in his music, and this is why I never had any problem to feel his music. I know exactly how it must sound, for me.
Well, I want to play. I'm going to play another one of his pieces here. This one is actually his composition, and it's in I guess you could say, the sadder vein in a light sort of way. It's called Lilacs. Also mm-hmm. comes from your recording of Rachmaninoff transcriptions from several years ago, and it's Olga Karin, my guest here on Live and Local. Thank you. Music by Rachmaninoff called Lilacs. Ola Karen performed. She's going to play Rachmaninoff's Rhapsody on a theme of Paganini with the Peoria Symphony tomorrow night. And is my guest just briefly here on Live and Local. When you have these little pieces like this, do you take a, never mind about Rachmaninoff himself, but do you take a different approach as a performer? Do you have a different attitude towards them than, say, a really big piece like a Chopin piano sonata or a large concerto?
I would say that, you know, every piece I need to have a unique approach. And it doesn't matter which kind of size of the piece it is. Because even in the small transcription like this, like Lilacs, he put so much interesting ideas in it that this music just make me completely fascinating, and I want to get as much as possible the details and everything to make this piece sound perfect. And the same with the big piece. It's all very similar, I would say, but with transcriptions in particular, of course I always need to approach the piece knowing that it's a transcription and somebody else wrote the original, and I always need to know the original composer piece, and then the structure and how it sounds. For example, Rachmaninoff has transcriptions of Mendelssohn and Bizet, and it's for the orchestra, and originally, you know, written for the orchestra, and to have this played just on the piano, it's always absolutely amazing for me how Rachmaninoff perfectly took exact sounds of the orchestra and transcribed it to the piano. Only genius can do this, you know. And Lilacs, for example, is a song. It's his song for the voice and piano. And on the piano, it's just this piece sounds like somebody's singing, you know. And this is what I always need to remember, you know, every piece like transcription. I always need to remember that the original composition was written for the orchestra or violin or the voice, and then I need to bring this is the Rachmaninoff's touch, I need to bring this to alive just by the piano, but it needs to sound like not just the piano, it needs to sound more than that, it needs to sound like original version but better, you know. And this is my approach usually for this kind of pieces.
Well, since you mentioned it, we don't have you playing a recording of you playing a Rachmaninoff orchestral piece. Here is Rachmaninoff's transcription of an orchestral piece, which you just mentioned, Mendelssohn's Midsummer Night's Dream, the Scherzo. And I know you got to go teach a master class. We'll let you go do it. Thanks very much for joining us on Live and Local.
Thank you. My pleasure. Thank you.
That is music you're going to hear again in several minutes, probably. It is played on the Native American flute. More about that in a moment, in a very few moments. But the music that you heard just before that was by Felix Mendelssohn, as transcribed by Sergei Rachmaninoff. It comes from Mendelssohn's Incidental Music to Shakespeare's Midsummer Night's Dream. And it was played by pianist Olga Kern, who will be playing Rachmaninoff's Rhapsody on the Theme of Paganini with the Peoria Symphony Orchestra tomorrow night. The concert starts at 8 o'clock in the Peoria Civic Center Theater. The program also includes Richard Wagner's overture to his opera The Flying Dutchman, Claude Debussy's Prelude to the Afternoon of a Faun, and Richard Strauss's Death and Transfiguration. All will be conducted by music director George Stelluto. For more information, you can go to peoriasymphony.org. This is Live and Local. I'm Kevin Kelly. Our broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from the Meredith Foundation, dedicated to supporting the musical arts in performance and presentation. Our next segment has a couple of performers with us who are going to be playing live. We'll also be hearing from that recording that we just heard a sample of, and one other having to do with the Native American flute. My guests are Peggy Gates Winicky and William. Do you say Rieger or Rieger?
Rieger.
And both of them started playing this instrument at about the same time, roughly 2007 or so, and are both involved in something called the Sangamon Valley Flute Circle in Springfield. And usually, of course, we have people here who are going to be giving a public performance. Live and Local is in large part about helping connect performers with an audience. Today's occasion is a little bit different in that Peggy and William are really interested in finding some kindred spirits, other folks who play this instrument, a little closer to Champaign-Urbana, I guess, because you both live here and and drive to Springfield, which, of course, is a great place to drive to. Not the most thrilling drive, you know, between here and there. I'm gathering that you're not aware of other performers on this instrument right around here, or just not enough.
Yeah, we're not aware of very many people in the community, and I had contacted ethnomusicologist on campus a few years ago, and he didn't know anybody who played the Native American flute.
Bruno Nettle?
I'm not sure. No. I can't remember the name. But yeah, so we don't know very many people, and we would really like to encourage people who are interested in the flute or just enjoy the music to join us. And in addition to that, just any other world flutes too, because as we were just talking about a few minutes ago, it's not just the Native American flute, but a few of the guys in the flute circle play flutes from Japan or China. You know, we've been to a conference that included flutes from the Turkish ney to the I'm just spacing some.
You have overtone flutes that are popular in Scandinavia, Western Russia. You have the fuyarka, which is a really interesting flute, sort of like a bassoon almost, with a long tube. And there's a lot of different kinds of flutes that people play, so we want to attract as many as possible.
Well, just listening to that sample that we heard a bit ago makes me think of flutes from various parts of the world. I mean, there's a kindred sound and maybe a kindred spirit. I'm thinking, for example, from Japan, the shakuhachi, which is right. Probably quite different, but maybe some similarities. There's the various wooden flutes from South America that have you know, like the El Condor Pasa, the Simon and Garfunkel used that sound in there. There's some characteristics there, too. And I'm just looking at the instruments that you each brought with you. Well, actually, I see a whole bunch that you've brought with you. And not one of them looks like another.
No,
I'm looking at it's about four or five, William, that you've got there, and maybe as many, Peggy. And they don't look anything like each other. So tell me two things, not necessarily in this order, and you can each have your own take on it. Since there seem to be so many different things, what is a Native American flute, and what got you interested in playing it?
Well, the great thing about the Native American flute is that it has two chambers. There's a slow air chamber right after the mouthpiece that you blow into. The air slows down, and then it travels through a tiny little duct under the bird, or the fetish is what it's called. And then it travels.
He's showing me, but of course you can't see what he's showing me.
Those of you in Radio Land can see this quite easily. But the air flows down the longer chamber to make the sounds with the key, the fingering holes and so forth. But that's the thing that makes this flute unique from other kinds of flutes. For example, I have here a Chinese zhao made in Taiwan by a little fellow who lives on a mountain and makes flutes for a living. And you can see maybe that it's just a tube.
It goes straight through. There's no pre-tube.
There's a notch at the end, and the air splits at the notch, and the air travels as quickly as it can down the tube. This is not a tube. There's a block here that slows the air down.
So that's characteristic of all Native American flutes, generally speaking?
Generally speaking, but you also have the Anasazi flutes, which are rim-blown. They're also an open tube, like the zhao. And some of the earlier flutes were merely bone or cane or something like that with a notch. So they resemble the zhao. But the flutes with the block are the native names for these flutes usually translate into something like big pith. So you have pibiguan or chotanka, words like that in various languages, refer to the big pith. If you can think of bamboo or river cane, the stem has these sections that block off the insides of the cane. And so the earliest native flutes in the east, eastern woodlands, tended to have these pithy bits with a hole on either side that the native would control with his finger as he blew in it. And there might be another two holes down here, so he could direct the air over the pith and then change it with his fingers. Mm. So there's two basic structural styles in history that the natives used. They used the pipe, which is the open tube, and they use the pith, which is the closed tube, a little more delicate. In terms of sound, some of the earliest Europeans described it as a very melancholy sound, whereas they would describe the pipe made out of bone or something with a notch at the end as a very harsh sound and unpleasing.
The Europeans would.
Right, the Europeans who first encountered these kinds of flutes.
You want to give us a quick demonstration?
Of this?
Yeah.
Sure.
So obviously we had both flutes join in. William Rieger played first, and then Peggy Gates, you just say Winicky, right, joined there. And again, these very different looking instruments and sounding, different sounding instruments too.
Those should have sounded pretty similar because they're both F sharps. But there's sometimes a little bit of a difference. But they certain times you get flutes that are in the same key, and they don't necessarily match up really well.
Well, I was talking about tonal.
Yeah.
Tonal difference, right?
Yeah.
So what is yours made of, William?
This is made of zebra wood, which is an African tree. It's made by Ancient Territories, the company that makes it, the guy that makes it. And it's a little different in structure from what she was playing because it's triangular shaped with a flat fingerboard. Hers is rounder. And so he also splits his wood lengthwise instead of, or down the middle instead of, I don't know how you would describe this, instead of top and bottom, he has left and right sides.
And I'm just going to clarify the business of triangular shape. It does not mean this flute looks like a triangle. It says that the shape of the bore is somewhat triangular rather than cylindrical, right?
Mm-hmm.
And what, Peggy, what's yours made of? You know?
I don't know. I've never been able to figure it out. It's a very heavy wood, but it's
very
also
dark wood.
Been very stained. It's stained, I think, too. But it is a very hard, heavy wood. And just the difference in the hard versus the soft wood, you'll get a difference in tone.
Yeah. So how did you all decide to, what made you interested in picking this up?
Well, I had been interested. I had enjoyed listening to the music for so long, and I picked up a catalog one day and saw that, you know, this foundation in the Southwest sold the flutes, and I went, whoa, you know, maybe I should get one. And of course I procrastinated and didn't buy one for a long time, and then finally I ended up buying one, and I loved it and found out that you can't just have just one. And that's the real key, is because they're all made in different keys, they all have very different sounds. They're just all, it's all special to have, you know, many flutes, and many people can't figure that out because in, you know, most instruments you just need one good silver flute or one good violin or whatever. And in this particular genre, you have to have them all.
And is this a compulsion thing, or is this a, if you want to really be complete?
Wink, wink, don't tell my wife.
Yeah, right.
It's not so much a compulsion. My first flute was a little Jonah Thompson A minor in pine, a very simple flute. I got it from my children for Father's Day in 2007. I'd actually been taking bagpipe lessons from Jim Lynch, who used to give them for free over at the Clark Lindsay. So I did that for a couple of years, but I wasn't, you know, mentally interested enough, I suppose, to go farther with it. So getting the flute was a much better experience musically. You could do more with it than the chanter, which is what I was learning on. So in this zebrawood flute is actually the second flute I got. And so more flutes means more capacity to play different ways and with different people. And it is a bit of a compulsion because you're always thinking about what is your next flute? What do you need in your collection, or what is a good sound? I keep it to a couple flutes a year, so it's not that bad.
And is your story similar to Peggy's and just how you decided to get into it? You like the music?
I did. I like the music. I got this little pine flute, and my wife teaches elementary school here in town, and I would go up to school with her in the evening when she was doing work, and I'd play in the stairwell and record myself with the echoing sound. It was very pleasant, very satisfying.
And I would think that an echoing sound is almost essential to this
it
music.
Is. We were talking with Mike, the sound guy.
Yeah, Mike Pritchard.
And to play in a canyon out in the Southwest is just the ultimate, because you can get in those narrow canyons and the sound just reverberates off of it, and it just is amazing.
What can you tell us about how the flute was and maybe to some extent still is used in Native cultures, Aboriginal cultures?
Oh, well, that's a good question. The flute is one of those cultural things that was taken away in the 1890s after the massacre at Wounded Knee, and the vast majority of Native peoples were on reservations and losing their culture quite rapidly. By the 30s and 40s, however, you see a renaissance of the flute in certain Native circles. Now, back in the days of the explorers, when the first settlers were coming in, the flute was really integrated into the culture. They used it for ceremonies. They used it for signaling on war or hunting campaigns. They did various ways, and they used it for courting, too, which was a big use for this particular
courting.
Flute. Authentically, yes. Each man would create a flute according to the dimensions of his own body. So it was as long as his arm, and he measured the whole spacing with his hands and his thumbs. So if he was a short guy, likely his flute would be a little higher. If he was a taller guy, it would be a little lower.
Higher, lower in pitch, you mean.
In pitch, right. And so, you know, he could go off into the woods or down by the river and play his special song for his girl and then be... you know, she would hear it and know that he was out there thinking for her, thinking of her, and so forth. But according to some, the flute would, once you caught the girl and married her, the flute would go back into the, you know, the storage.
It better had, you know, so he didn't catch anybody else. Well, Peggy has just picked up her tall guy flute, it looks like. This is a very long and a little fatter
flute,
than the other ones we've seen.
To a very small flute, I could just play a real brief thing with my... wide variety of sounds you would have heard back in the day.
But all three of those that you've played, or the four that we've heard so far, are they all have the same principle that William described earlier of,
right.
of structure, construction,
correct.
And so on.
Yeah.
And how the thing works.
So by the time we get to the 70s, the flute has...
Which 70s are we talking about?
1970s. 1970s.
Okay.
The flute has moved more into the Anglo-American mainstream. We start to see the use of it in New Age music. And then Michael Graham Allen, who is one of the greatest flute makers today, I guess, he was instrumental in tuning it to a concert tuning so it can play with other instruments. And so the flute has really taken off among Anglo-American populations. Some in the Native American populations still have, I think, some reticence about using it just as entertainment. Typically, it's not a female instrument, it's a male instrument. And so players, performers like Mary Youngblood, who is a multiple NAMI Award winner, people sometimes look a little strange at her that she's playing this male instrument. But she's very good, and I think in many ways instrumental in breaking the flute out of its more traditional ruts or grooves or whatever.
Well, we have a recording here of, and I left the jacket over with Mike in the other room. Do you remember who the performer is? This is the one with solo.
Brian Akipa,
and he comes from?
He's a Lakota, I think, Lakota Sioux from South Dakota, and he makes his own flutes. They're absolutely beautiful flutes, and we heard him play last summer at a conference up in Wisconsin, and He's just a really, really wonderful native player.
Do you know where this recording was made and what kind of a setting?
No, I don't.
He's an elementary teacher by trade, I should put in.
Yeah.
Well, because, you know, we're able to add a little reverberation
right.
to your sound in this very dry room. But this one sounds like, even if it wasn't, it could have been recorded in a canyon.
It
so it's got some
been,
of that
yeah.
sound. Let's give a listen.
Thank you.
That was a performance by a flutist named Brian Akipa from his CD called Song of the Aspen. And this was called Singing to the Four Directions. He's from one of the Sioux tribes. And heard here on Live and Local on FM 90.9, where our broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from the Meredith Foundation, dedicated to supporting the musical arts in performance and presentation. We also have support from the Sousa Archives and Center for American Music, breathing life into the history of our nation's musical past through exhibits, guided tours, and performances at the University of Illinois. More information is available, and visits can be scheduled at 217-244-9309. You're able to take this show and WYLL generally with you anywhere you go now if you obtain the WYLL app. It's free. If you have an iPhone, iPad, or Android device, it can let you stream both of our stations here. You can listen to past episodes of some of your favorite shows. For more information about how to find the WYLO radio app in the App Store or Google Play, you can visit our website at will.illinois.edu. My guests in our studio are Peggy Gates-Winicky and William Rieger, both of whom participate in something called the Sangamon Valley Flute Circle in Springfield. And they're interested in learning about other people who either play the various forms of Native American flute or, I guess, are interested in playing. You could hook up. Do you, either of you do some teaching, or do you know teachers, or have you learned from teachers, or how did you get going on this?
I've taken lessons from some of the flute players who come to the conferences I've attended, and I also teach a class on frontier history at Illinois State University. I use the flute in that class as an artifact to teach my students about Native culture.
I've never taken a lesson from anybody other than my friends, and I learn a lot from all the people that I play with.
So in other words, if you were to start, say, a Champaign-Urbana flute circle, people could learn from you or from
exactly, and we would love to share with them everything that we know. So.
And if one of our listeners from around the world, since we do stream the show, might like to join, you know, help you form a circle in our area, how would they get hold of you?
Well, I guess I can give you my email address and at peggygates12@gmail.com. And if somebody, especially here in Champaign-Urbana, is interested, I would love to hear from them.
And that's just P-E-G-G-Y-G-A-T-E-S.
12, 12, 12.
At gmail.com.
Correct.
And that'll get you to Peggy Gates-Winicky. Yeah. And if you didn't hear that or you forget it, you can always contact me at WILL and I'll put you in touch with either Peggy or William. Well, you've got, do we have octaves now between these two flutes that you have?
Yes, this is an E flute, and that's an E flute much higher.
So we heard the high one from Peggy earlier, but we haven't heard the larger one from Maria before.
Thank you.
Does that have a name?
No, I should point out that our music, I call it music in the moment. We had no idea that song would exist 2 seconds before I started playing.
Seriously?
Yes.
Seriously. So that was all improvised?
All improvised.
Fabulous.
That's how we play. Primarily, that's what we
really?
Do.
So. Well, that makes it all the more special. I'm sort of glad I didn't know that first. but I'm glad I know it now. William Rieger and Peggy Gates-Winicky, thanks very much for joining us on Live and Local.
You're welcome.
Thank you for having us.
Be happy to have you back, by the way. If you get folks together, let's bring them all in and let's see
will.
What happens.
We will. We will do it.
Here are some events you can see and hear live in our listening area over the next couple of days. I'm really picking and choosing here, and sort of a theme, as you will hear. University of Illinois Symphony Orchestra is playing tonight at the Krannert Center in Urbana at 7:30. The Eastern Illinois University Wind Symphony and Jazz Ensemble are playing at the Dowden Fine Arts Center in Charleston, also tonight at 7:30. The Millikan Decatur Symphony Orchestra is performing a concert, including Mahler's Kinder Totenlieder with Andrea Frakes Pope at the Kirkland Fine Arts Center on the Millikan campus in Decatur on Saturday at 7:30. And the Illinois State University Wind Symphony is performing at the ISU Center for the Performing Arts in Normal Sunday afternoon at 3 o'clock. At the same time, the University of Illinois Wind Orchestra and Parkland College Wind Ensemble are at the Krannert Center in Urbana, as is the Illinois Wesleyan University Wind Ensemble at Westbrook Auditorium in Bloomington. All three of those are Sunday afternoon at 3 o'clock. So a lot of university things going on this weekend, and in some cases, you're going to have to make a choice. You're listening to 90.9 WYNL FM and HD Urbana with Translator, W293 AF Danville, NPR Classical Music and More for Central Illinois. WYNL is a member-supported service of the College of Media at Illinois. And we'll go out with a recording that involves the Native American flute with a bunch of other instruments. This is called The Sand Was Hot, She Wanted to Dance, and it features flutist Mark Holland here on Live and Local.